There is only one major professional sport where women and men go head-to-head for the same prizes. Horse racing. Jump Girls is an observational feature documentary which tells the story of that, and we caught up with the writer-director Luke McManus to hear all about it. I'm delighted to say we're joined now by Luke McManus, the director of Jump Girls. Episode 1 airs on TG Car on Thursday. Luke, how's it going?
Yeah, very well, thank you, Mark.
This must be the exciting time, is it, before it finally goes out and you get to see the reaction?
Yeah, no, it's 14 months later, you know, so, and in fact, it's probably nearly the guts of 2 years later from the first proposal writing, so you do kind of go, man, we're almost there. We did have a screening in the IFI last week, which was open to the public, but also there was a lot of the people are taking part in the documentary there, so that was probably the most nerve-wracking thing, because sitting in the cinema looking at your films always high pressure, and then when you've got like Ruby Walsh and Jessica Harrington's kind of eyeballs bored into the back of your head as well from the cinema, you're kind of you're extra nervous, but they all seem to love it, so happy days.
What made you want to tell this story?
Well, to be fair, TG Carr actually, I think, came up with the idea. We did Jump Boys myself, mm-hmm. and I was asked to direct Jump Boys by Touchline Media, Stephen Cullinan and Dennis Kerwin, who had a dream of doing this project for a long time, which was about Ruby Walsh, Barry Gerrity and Davy Russell, who are obviously, they're still the three best national hunt jockeys around. And that went brilliant for us, and we did a few more horse racing projects after that. And then TG Carr were like, well, we'd love to do Jump Girls, and me and the lads were like, yeah, we'd like to do it too, but when and why? And then Jessica Arrington had this crazy season where, you know, she won the Irish Grand National with our Duke. She had one horse that won the Punchestown Gold Cup, the Leopardstown Gold Cup, the Cheltenham Gold Cup in its season, which was Sizing John, which was a historic moment that had never happened before. So suddenly it was like, wow, you know, maybe now's the time to get on this horse. So that's kind of what then pushed it over the line.
There's a lovely moment at the start where Ted Walsh gives his own description of female jockeys or what that might be about. Would you subscribe to his theory?
Yeah, I think Ted's in a bit of trouble about that, actually. But I won't say too much, but he was a bit mortal when he saw it in the film. Ted's a documentary maker's dream. You know, like, you point a camera at Ted, he's going to say something interesting. Like, he's obviously a very talented horse trainer, but he's a natural broadcaster and a natural talker. And yeah, you know, I think there are certain things that men do better than women, for sure. You know what I mean? And, like, you're reluctant to generalize, you know, about these things, but you can't help thinking that for all the sexism and disadvantages that might be facing you as a female jockey, there might be some kind of advantages too. And I think Rachel actually says that in the film, Rachel Blackmore.
Yeah, because there's an interesting moment where Shark Hamlin is talking about where Rachel Blackmore cut her teeth, and he talks about initially getting bad rides on point to point, like she was even disadvantaged at that level. And I'm wondering, like, when you initially were approached with this idea, was the idea of maybe a gender imbalance something that loomed over you?
No, I think Rachel's story and the fact that Jessica had that brilliant season and then that Rachel won the Jockeys Championship, conditional championship, sorry, which for listeners that don't know is like starting out jockeys have a weight allowance and you're a conditional jockey. So they're not quite apprentices, but they're junior jockeys who are just getting established. And she was the first woman ever to win that. So suddenly you felt right, you have this 70-year-old super trainer woman and you have this up-and-coming incredible jockey who's obviously got like one of the biggest talents of her generation. So you kind of think, right, like there is something in this now, you know. And then you start going looking, and I think one of the big challenges with the film was there's a lot of characters in it, so that's always difficult to manage as a filmmaker, because you're trying to go, well, you know, if there's too many people are just going to not engage, and how do you create sympathy and get inside someone's head? And, you know, like it was a hard enough project on a lot of levels, but very enjoyable to do, and they were brilliant, and it was really great to see them in the IFI watching it on the big screen and enjoying it so much.
Hard in what way?
Hard, I suppose, number one, many characters. Mm-hmm. So you can't just go, I mean, when we made Jump Boys, it was about Ruby, Davy and Barry. But if you watch it back, it's really about Davy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen it, but it was about Davy Russell's kind of quest to get the monkey of the Jockeys Championship off his back. And that became our narrative arc. So as a filmmaker in documentaries, you're always trying to figure out what's my structure, who's my protagonist, where am I going? So with Jump Boys, it was like, okay, it's about Davy, really, and Ruby's his sort of antagonist, and Barry's kind of this other character who's Ruby's mate, who's also an amazing jockey. So with Jump Girls, we had a trainer, we had, you know, jockeys that were doing brilliantly, we had jockeys that were amateurs, we had jockeys that were professional, we had two in the UK. So you're just trying to manage a lot of different threads, and to keep that in your head is kind of challenging. And then, like, jockeys are really busy. Like it's kind of hard to carve out time with them. They're riding out every morning. They spend their lifetime behind the wheel. Like, and on the big days when you're most interested in them, they have the least time for you.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. You know, and that is hard as well, you know. So, but look, this is why they call it work, you know. I mean, it's not like they were all sound and really good to work with, you know what I mean? So it wasn't really difficult, but you're just like, you realize, I think as well with certain athletes and their level of focus is so high, you know, you're some storyteller, wants to tell a story about them. That's not really their priority,
yeah.
You know. So you kind of have to just work with that.
Because I guess from the viewer's perspective, one of the things I was kind of taken with throughout the film is that there's real power in it. And I think one of the moments that from a viewer what they would find hard is when you see Lisa O'Neill, but you also see your parents and their reaction to a fall. And I'm wondering, are you conscious of that at the time, or is it only when you see that play out on the screen that you realize how like powerful that is?
Yeah, I think you realize it's an interesting thing actually when you're making these docs. I find you start off making a documentary about women in racing, you end up making a documentary about something else. Like with Jump Boys, it ended up kind of being about failure and about how to exercise your demons.
Yeah.
You know, when I was making Arkle, it kind of became about Ireland versus England and how inferior we felt to England back in the 60s. You know, like a team, you know, that is parallel to the main subject. And with Jump Girls, it sort of became about families, you know, and about parents and fathers and daughters, yeah, and mothers and daughters, and, you know, and it became about the dynamic that happens between parents and their children. So that moment with Tommy and Margaret, Lisa O'Neill's parents, we were interested in them originally because of the viral video of them watching her Cheltenham,
yeah,
which was quite a big, you know, story that came out of Cheltenham the previous year. And I said, well, they're obviously a bit of crack and we have to go there. So then you met them, and like Tommy's got this brilliant sort of weather-beaten jockey's face, and Margaret's very kind of charismatic kind of woman as well. And you go, right, these are good. Let's spend some time with them. And ultimately, your jockey is down the other end of a race course, so you have to spend the race with someone.
Yeah, sure.
And it might as well be the ones with the most skin in the game.
Yeah.
You know, and you'd think maybe the owner or the trainer have the most skin in the game. But, you know, Gordon Elliott has a camera in his face 24 hours a day. He knows not to give stuff away, you know? Whereas with... So you're always looking for emotion and relationships and love and danger and drama, you know? So I guess, like, it was very unlucky for Lisa, but in a sort of weird way, it's kind of lucky for us.
Yeah. I guess as a director, you have to be very fluid if that's the case. I mean, you probably don't have a story and arc in your head because this is all unplannable.
Totally. I think it's Ron Howard said, every day I show up on location with a plan, but inside I'm praying someone's got a better one.
Okay.
You know, and you kind of do go, right, well, I need some sort of a plan, but you do have to be flexible enough to kind of rock and roll it and just follow your nose. And you end up going up blind alleys and cul-de-sacs and, you know, things that don't really pay off for you, and certain storylines just don't make it, you know?
Yeah.
But, and I think you always feel you need to be fair as well. Like, Lisa O'Neill is a really brilliant jockey. I mean, I think she's won 29 races this year, which as an amateur is extraordinary. She's going to be champion lady amateur again. She might even be champion amateur, potentially. So she's a huge, high-achieving, amazing talent. And you feel then, God, am I only really... The only story I'm telling about her is her coming off a horse, you know? So you're trying to balance it up the whole time. But I suppose when we're making these things, like Stephen and Dennis are huge racing fans. I've become a racing fan over the years. But you're always thinking, I want non-racing fans to watch this.
Yeah.
And I suppose even if you're, you've no interest in racing, maybe you're a parent, maybe you're a sister, maybe you're a daughter or a son, and you can relate to that level of parental concern about when a child is put in danger. So it's fairly universal. So I guess that's why you end up telling those stories, because they're universal.
And I guess that was one of my questions I was going to ask you, is there like a universal theme or a message you wanted viewers to end up taking away after watching it? And maybe that's it.
Well, you'd be... Samuel, I'm a great man for the quotes this morning. If you want to send a message, try Western Union, Samuel Galvin. Like, don't, you know, you don't necessarily want to put a message in your film, but sure. I suppose you do want to provoke a little bit of big picture thinking in people. And, you know, as we were going through the process, it started off being a film about women in racing, but then we kind of realized this is actually a film about the sport where men and women go head to head.
Yeah.
Like, there are other sports. There's fencing and sailing and Formula One, but none of them are major spectator sports in Ireland, you know? So the only proper sport, in my mind, on a professional public spectator level where men and women are equal, is horse racing. And women's sports, obviously, rightly, finally getting a bit of a profile that it's long deserved. And you see the popularity and the level of public interest in, you know, Kelly Harrington, Katie Taylor, Annalise Murphy, you know, beyond Serena Williams and people like that who have just become massive iconic figures. But none of them take on the men.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you see Rachel Blackmore, she is now three races. She's in second place in the Jockeys Championship as we speak, behind Paul Townend. The names below her in that table are Barry Garrity, Davy Russell, Ruby Walsh, Jack Kennedy, you know, Sean Flanagan. Like, these are some of the best jockeys who've ever lived, and she's leaving them in her wake. It's fantastic.
Before I want to get on to Rachel, before we do, I think two of the kind of standout characters are Nina Carberry and yes, Katie Walsh, who are referenced throughout it by younger jockeys as right, being kind of influences or yeah, trailblazers. But yeah, I'm wondering, when you were dealing with them, do you think they were conscious of that?
Yeah, I think they probably were. Yeah, I think Katie particularly, her interest in Rachel is quite powerful. Like, you know, that, like, she has so much time for Rachel, so much respect for her. Like, she spoke about her in such glowing terms. And you won't find anyone with a bad word to say about Rachel, actually, you know. So Katie, she was writing in the Herald yesterday, or the Independent, and Independent, I think, Katie Walsh, and she was talking about the film, saying, you know, Rachel's done it without being somebody's daughter. I'm paraphrasing. But, you know, yeah, obviously Nina Carberry is Paul Carberry's sister, Tommy Carberry's daughter. Katie Walsh comes from the Walsh dynasty. Rachel Blackmore's from a farm in Tipperary. Her mother's a school teacher. Her father's a farmer. They're not racing royalty or anything like it. So I think there's a level of respect there from Katie and Nina towards Rachel that's, you know, very palpable, like, you know. Again, like, the family team coming back, though, Nina and Katie's relationship as their sister-in-laws, you know, they're very, very close, and they're sort of coming all the way up together, you know, and retiring together. Like, I think it was brilliant for them to have one another in that way room, because, you know, and you see, Rachel says that, I think, when they retired and they set part two, she's like, I'm going to miss them.
Yeah, especially in, like, not necessarily the big occasions, but a Thursday in Clonmel, I think, was their line. Like,
the harsh on Thurles or Clonmel or something, yeah. For a Tipperary woman, she's getting herself into trouble there, like, you know. But you know, racing is a bit of a grind. Like, it's not like being a Premiership footballer and you're just playing PlayStation all week and you show up and, you know, play one or two matches. I mean, these women are driving around the country 5 days a week, you know, and they are showing up to these fairly unglamorous. I mean, Rachel Blackmore's ridden 500 rides or something already this year.
Yeah.
I mean, that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
You know, like, she's ridden more horses than anyone else in the country by a mile. Like,
yeah.
Like, she's the hardest working jockey. So, you know, you've got up at the crack of dawn, you've driven to Ballinrobe, you know, and if there's no one else in that ladies' weigh room with you, that's a fairly miserable, I'm guessing, or at least a bit of a lonely existence.
Yeah, I said that. I think that was one of the takeaways, is how, like, they're, you know, this idea of standing up by yourself. Like, we might as well go on to Rachel, because it's a team already. But you reference, you know, a documentary maker's dream at the start of her gift.
Yeah.
The narrative arc of her starting out, and that footage of her and Townsend on the point of
yeah,
to now challenging Must have been perfect.
It was fantastic. And I don't know how. That footage only came up kind of late in the day. You know, and I think her mother, I don't know if Rachel mentioned it first. She did. And then I asked her mother, and her mother dug it out. And yeah, like, it's just this amazing circularity. And to see her at that young age winning that, and the footage is just, it's like something from Dunbelievables. Like, it's like, like, I was like, would you not wipe the lens? Like, the lens is totally covered in rainwater. But the guy doing the commentary, the interview, is brilliant. Like he's really good commentator. I'm like, he should be doing big races. He's amazing. Like, and the mic and seeing her. But as I say, you see her ride. In fact, I think Ruby Walsh particularly enjoyed that footage at the premiere. Someone was telling me he was looking at him and he was nearly doubled over laughing at it.
On the idea about it not appealing to race fans, or how it might be a kind of a universal idea, like, when you went into it, were you a race fan?
So, yes, but when I started Jump Boys, and I've done an article and I did a four-parter about Galway races called Shockton and Rossi. So going into Jump Boys, I literally didn't know one end of a horse from another. I mean, I remember Alan Sweetman, who's a pal of mine, who's got a column in the Racing Post, sitting me down and saying, this is how you read a race card.
Okay,
like, and yeah. I literally just, it was just, that was the page in the paper that I flicked over. You know what I mean? I just had no interest in it. And it's funny because it's often the way that if you don't know something about something, you kind of dismiss it a bit, you know?
Yeah.
But there's so much depth in racing, Jesus, you know? And I still know almost nothing about it.
Yeah.
But I know enough now to kind of enjoy it. But, you know, as a documentary maker, I always said at the time of Jump Boys, it's kind of a good place to be the ignorant Aegis asking the stupid questions. You know, that kind of Bill O'Hurley, Louis Theroux. Like, you're not afraid to ask Ruby Walsh after the champion hurdle, did you make a mistake there? I remember asking that question and, like, hearing people wincing and going, you know, because, oh, my God, he's asked Ruby Walsh, did he make a bollocks of a race? But yeah. It didn't... There was no pressure on me because I didn't understand the significance of it, you know what I mean? So it's a, but like, it's an interesting world on a lot of levels. I've always found it kind of, the strangeness of it is what fascinates me most, I suppose.
You know? And on that, one of the strengths of the documentary is probably the access that you're allowed. I think there's only one moment where there seems to be a bit of hesitancy, which is when Rachel seems desperate not to talk to anybody after she lost, and she's kind of trying to put out of the room. But other than that, they seem to be, from looking from a viewer's perspective, they seem to be very welcoming of the idea.
Ah, they were great. I mean, look, some people are naturally better at it than others, or more into it.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I don't think Rachel is that into it. Like, okay, yeah. I think Rachel is into winning races.
Yeah.
And talking to the likes of me is way down her list of ways she wants to spend her time. Like, so I felt a bit of pressure. We all did, myself and Stephen and Dennis, all felt pressure that, you know, to make sure that we represented her as we found her. And Rachel is great cracking and really smart and just a brilliant woman. Like, you know, I've huge time for her. I'm like such a fan of hers. But a lot of the time she'd just be like, lads, no. Or, you know, she'd just say, I want to thank the trainers. And you're kind of like, oh, Jesus, Rachel. You know, so, but we did get enough moments, I think, and put them all together. I mean, I think you're talking about the Grand National, I presume, are
you? Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And it's kind of one of the worst things about being a filmmaker is you have to kind of stick your nose in and go, even when you know someone doesn't want to talk to you, you have to try.
Yeah, so to put this in context for our listeners, the race hasn't gone well. And
no, at she, all.
And she is kind of making a beeline to leave, is gathering her stuff. And then there's a question asked, how did it go? Is the first question, I think.
Okay.
And then it follows up by asking her...
brain dead question. Like.
So she says, not well. And he said, how do you feel, is the next question. And she said, no, I'm off, lads. So
yeah.
it was the first time where there was any sort of sign of... maybe hesitancy is the wrong word, but just not now, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, look, she had a plane to catch. She'd had a sickening fall. She was in pain, like.
Yeah.
And Stephen, the producer's always joking about that sequence going, there's like four... big men standing looking at her, not one of us would pick up her bag and carry it for her. But you can't pick up the bag, you know, like, that's filmmaking. You have to let what's happen, you know. And there was a debate in my mind. I didn't particularly want my questions to be in it or for me to have any role in the film, but that sequence didn't work without me being in it. And I think it's important because I think you get a sense of how pissed off she is and how sore she is. And And I think for the good days to work, you have to see what the bad days are like. And, you know, I always feel losing is a bit more victories. Defeat's a bit more interesting than victory to me.
And for you in the moment, I remember I spoke to Ross Whittaker after he did the Katie Taylor documentary, and he said the times when he really struggled was when Katie was speaking about her father, and it was times when he almost felt like he wanted to turn off the camera, but he was kind of conscious of the idea that it was more important for the story.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is that something that registered with you, even at, like, to stick on this exact moment for a second, is that something that registered you at the time?
Yeah, I think that's always the dilemma, because you are a professional storyteller and you need to gather as much stuff as you can when you're making a documentary and then make your editorial decisions later. So you're always rolling and you're always trying to capture stuff. But then on a human level, you know, you don't want to be intrusive or crass or insensitive or just a pain in the ass, you know? So you're always weighing that up. So you're basically always trying to find the line and not cross it. And inevitably you do cross it the odd time. But that's where you have to be, is right in that line as a filmmaker. So that is tough. But to be fair, they were all really generous and accommodating. And I think you always have to say to yourself, right, this is a bit awkward now, but in 6 months I'll be looking at this going, I'm really glad I did that. And this is an important part of the story. And I don't think you can tell Rachel's story of her immense success without seeing some low points. And having a low point, I think, makes you more invested in her eventual success when you see her suffering.
Yeah. On that idea, actually, of suffering, I think one of the kind of more endearing characters is Missing Harrington, particularly because at the very start, she's the one who references the fact that in the 60s they weren't allowed to hold a license, in the 70s was the first time they allowed jump. So it's a real nice starting point to see how far they have come. And then suddenly you get this idea with both our Duke and Sizing John of things going badly. So she is immensely successful with horses. And I'm kind of wondering, is that something that you sympathize with at the time, or is that something you only realize in retrospect how difficult that was? Because it's only when she, I think, from my own perspective anyway, it's only when she references it, as she says, I couldn't talk to anybody in the yard, as she's speaking directly to camera, that you realize just how challenging it was.
I think Jessica's amazing, first off. Like, my wife says I have a mommy issue based crush on Jessica. She is unbelievable. Like, last night I was do you know Jordan Peterson? You know that asswipe Jordan Peterson? I actually sat down and wrote down Jessica Harrington's 12 rules for life. And I'm going to put them on social media, because they were all based on things she said in the documentary or said to me. And, like, I just think her attitude to the world is unbelievable. Like, you know what I mean? So brilliant. But she, I suppose the Arduke thing, Jessica has suffered immensely in her life from bereavement.
Yeah.
Her husband, her brother was killed in an accident not that long ago. One of her best friends died in a riding accident. She broke her own neck. You know, like, she's had a lot of troubles in her life, and nothing seems to have dented her or put a stop to her positivity and her energy and her determination. So I tried to talk to her about that, not with any huge success, not because of her lack of generosity or openness, but more just, she's kind of like, move on, come on, you know, for God's sake, that's ages ago, you know, like, we're living in the now. And when you're making a documentary like this, you want to be doing events that are happening as you're filming and that are current and that are part of your story. So the Arduke thing sort of became a proxy for all the other losses that Jessica's kind of endured in her life. For me, it sort of symbolizes that. And then her attitude, and she goes, you know, no matter how you dress it up, you can cover it in fluffy bows and candy floss, but it's still bad news. Bad news is bad news. Like, she just doesn't duck the tough stuff, Jessica.
Yeah.
But she moves on. And it's a funny thing. Sometimes very tough women who are very high achieving have a reputation for being sort of, and it's probably a misogynistic, sexist thing, you know what I mean? Like, for being ball breakers and for being, you know, overly aggressive.
Yeah.
But what's brilliant about Jessica is one minute she's like being really hardcore, and the next minute she's like, oh, my stomach's gone like a washing machine. You know, I'm really nervous the morning of the Gold Cup or the morning of the Durkin. Like, she isn't afraid to expose her weaknesses or her mental turmoil when the pressure's on, you know. So she was just a gift. I just think she should do like a Guide to Life book, I think, you know what I mean, because she's got such wisdom to impart, like, you know. Yeah. And she's brilliant crack as well, like, I mean, she's just a sound out, you know.
So finally then, I suppose I'm wondering about your own feelings about the documentary now. So like, you're in a sweet spot where you don't really have the, you know, widespread public reaction, but you've seen your work yourself. So I kind of wonder, is your pride based off what you've seen now, or how do you feel about the documentary as it exists now, or will that become when you see how it does?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it goes back to a philosophical conundrum, you know, like, if the tree falls in the forest, does it make a sound?
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there, it doesn't make a sound, because a sound is human perception of air moving through the air, of something moving through the air. Sorry, I'm telling up why I'm talking about this, but sorry, my point is, audiences make films.
Yeah.
This is what I'm getting at. I'm not someone... Some people make films from a perspective of kind of artistic, and it's about personal expression and creativity, and that's a very valid way of making a film, and indeed of making a documentary. But I've always felt that you want the audience to be part of the process. And that's why screening it in the IFI that night, it just meant a lot on a number of... I mean, we did it for a lot of reasons, but what you get from it personally is that laugh when Ted says that line at the start, and sure, you go, okay, people are like laughing, they think it's funny, and that means they like the film more, because they think, oh, there's going to be a few laughs in here as well as a bit of drama, you know. And seeing and hearing them wince when that crunching sound of hitting the ground, and you see Lizzie Kelly flying through the air or whatever, when you're sitting among human beings in the cinema, that is marvelous. Like, there's no beating it, you know. But thankfully, with social media now, when it does go out on Thursday at 9:30 in TG Cahir, and afterwards on The Player, and repeated on Saturday at 8:15, obviously, you do get a bit of a sense of being among an audience and seeing people on hashtag JumpGirls, hopefully.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's a nice new thing. Social media has its ups and downs, but as a filmmaker who works for broadcast, seeing that traffic on a hashtag is kind of pleasing, because you're almost sitting in the dark with all those people watching it, you know.
Because it's a conundrum, isn't it, I think, for any creator, like, the idea of, you know yourself, that you should be independent of thought and have pride in your work, you know, without external factors, but you can't help but subscribe that to the reaction or to the public perception of after that.
Well, I'm an eldest child, so every day is an internal quest for validation and approval, so, you know, I've made my peace with that. You know, with films nowadays, you can't just make them and then sit back. You have to keep on driving them forward and telling a story around the film and trying to get people's awareness of it up. And, you know, the screening was part of that. We've been doing some work with 20 by 20, who are, you know, the campaigning group for the visibility of women's sport. And, like, they've been brilliant, you know, and the work they're doing is great. So, you know, there was obvious synergies there. So for me, it's a film for everyone, and it's obviously a film for racing fans and sports fans, but it's sort of a film for feminists and for any person who likes to see women achieve at the absolute highest level, you know, on a level playing field with men. And I think that's a big audience, so I'm hoping some of them will tune in.
On that, actually, I just, from my own perspective, I thought it was brilliant. I think it's, whatever about those kind of narratives, I think overall it's just a brilliant documentary that I would really encourage people to check out, because of, as I pre-mentioned, the power of it.
Thank,
as we said,
much.
It's airing on tomorrow, Thursday, which is the 21st, on TG Cahir. Part 2 is going to be next Thursday, which is the 28th. Luke, thanks for coming into us.
Appreciate it, Morris. Thank you.